Chapter 55 Modern Minutemen Environmental Warriors Minutemen at Concord Bridge Green Gorillas These phrases referred to Rainforest Action Network, the nonprofit where I was about to speak. Although Ren is famous for saving endangered forests, the articles I read on that flight reminded me of something I had thought about a half decade earlier and then pretty much forgot. They suggested that RAND can serve as a model for something bigger. These articles, in magazines ranging from the corporate Bible, Fortune, to Tricycle, the Buddhist Review, discussed in detail how volunteers practice freedom of speech through civil disobedience, street theater, and nonviolent protests. RAND's people march outside the headquarters of corporations, wave placards, and even scale buildings to drape them with banners that highlight the company's most blatant violations. They buy full-page newspaper ads and write letters to editors. However, they are careful never to harm people or property. And they offer to help executives fashion win-win approaches that benefit all parties. Those successes illustrated that we the people can motivate corporations to change. RAND proves that we can bend the will of the mightiest of the mighty. Change can serve corporate self-interests as well as those of the community at large. Those articles jarred my recollections of RAND's campaign in the mid-1990s to convince members of the Mitsubishi corporate family, at the time considered the world's most destructive logger of tropical forests, to change their policies. When Mitsubishi's managers rejected RAND's initial overtures and instead refused to negotiate, the endeavor took on a personal element. Mitsubishi officials faced off against RAND's founder and executive director. The exchanges were heated and sometimes personal. In the end, RAND emerged victorious. On November 12, 1997, Mitsubishi Motor Sales of America and Mitsubishi Electric America signed a historic agreement with RAND that committed the companies to, quote, ecological sustainability and social responsibility, unquote. In addition, they pledged to implement 14 specific steps aimed at fulfilling this commitment. Several months after this agreement was reached, I attended a conference on the California coast. I had heard that RAND's founder and executive director, Randy Hayes, would be among the conference's 36 or so participants. I looked forward to meeting this man, who had taken on a monumental challenge and was winning. In my opinion, he was a modern hero whose feet filled tracks put down by Tom Paine, Harriet Tubman, Martin Luther King Jr., Cesar Chavez, Rachel Carson, and others who aroused us to change the way we view ourselves and behave toward the world. The conference center was located high in the hills above the Pacific. I had decided to make a tent my home for the extended weekend, rather than accepting one of the rooms reserved for participants. I pitched my tent in a small field on a steep slope just above a clump of fir trees that hugged the top of the cliff overlooking the ocean. Although I would have to sleep on an incline, I could open the flap and look down on spectacular views of the rugged coast. Since the day was clear and mild, I did not worry too much about fine-tuning. The tent went up quickly, and I lay back to watch the sun creep toward the horizon. The scent of fur mingling with that of the ocean was intoxicating. Suddenly, I sat up and looked at my watch. I had dozed off for nearly half an hour. I roused myself and headed down to the reception cocktail party, my reluctance to leave this idyllic setting offset by my eagerness to meet RAND's executive director. I had no idea that Randy's arch-rival, an executive from Mitsubishi, was at that very moment on his way to the same cocktail party. I recognized Randy immediately from the press photos. I introduced myself, expressed my appreciation for his work, and congratulated him on his recent victory. We chatted about my experiences in the Amazon. Then he glanced at the door. A look of surprise crossed his face. He excused himself and strolled over to the man who had just entered. They shook hands, exchanged a few words, and then we all were asked to be seated so the conference could officially begin. The woman sitting at my side whispered that the newcomer was a Mitsubishi executive. After that first greeting, he and Randy seemed to avoid each other. The next day was intense with group meetings. During dinner, I invited Randy to join me for a beer at the hot tub, where we could continue the discussion begun the day before. We arrived at the top of the cliff above the Pacific Ocean and headed along a narrow trail. As we approached the tub, we noticed that someone was already in it. The Mitsubishi executive seemed equally shocked to see us. But he recovered quickly, smiled up from the bubbles, and raised his own beer can. "Beautiful sunset," he observed. "Please join me." I felt rather anxious as we stripped down and stepped into the hot water. Here I was, alone on this mountain, the only person between these two men who until recently had been arch rivals. We talked about the events of the afternoon, reviewed conference matters, and discussed other participants who were mutual friends. We studiously shunned any reference to the recent conflict. The sun dropped into the ocean. The sky went from pink to magenta to purple. We opened another round of beers and clicked our cans together. Randy and I sipped from ours, but our companion continued to hold his high. "I have something important to say to you, Randy." Randy looked directly at him. I sensed that he, like me, had no idea of what to expect. "I need to thank you," the other continued. "I and a number of Mitsubishi managers wanted to change our policies long before Ran came calling, but we didn't dare confront our board. We were afraid we'd get fired. Your protesters and ads forced the issue. It was tough. You made us all pretty uncomfortable. But ultimately, you brought us together. Someone pointed out that our responsibilities shouldn't stop with today's stockholders. They should include the stockholders' kids, our kids. Ran gave us an opportunity. We convinced ourselves, our company, to do the right thing." He leaned toward Randy. Their cans clicked again. Mine joined theirs. "Thank you," he said. Later that night, a storm moved in off the Pacific. I woke up, listening to the rain hammer my tent and thinking about the evening. The Mitsubishi man's words offered hope. Like me during my days as an EHM, he and his fellow executives had understood what needed to be done to make the world better, but they felt trapped in a system that demanded they not listen to their conscience. I recalled how in my heart I had known that many of my actions were wrong, but things conspired to convince me otherwise. Business schools, international organizations, and revered economists taught that building huge infrastructure projects was essential to development, the solution to poverty. I was praised for following the formula. I was promoted, given raises, larger staffs, power, sex, corporate stock, a partnership, insurance, all the things that define success in our society. I was invited to lecture at the world's most prestigious colleges and wined and dined by heads of state. The Mitsubishi executive had experienced something similar, he and all those other men and women who surrounded him. Their careers were devoted to the bottom line, short-term dollar profits, promotions, benefits. Their children's health care depended on the quarterly income statement. They had been trained to see the world through wine-colored boardroom glasses. Then Ran entered the picture. The wind picked up. Howling at my tent, it seemed to proclaim nature's determination to set things right. The words of an Andean shaman returned to me. "The world doesn't need to be saved," she said. "The world is not in danger. We are. We humans. If we don't change our ways, Mother Earth will shake us off like so many fleas." Now the shaking had begun. This night seemed symbolic of the larger shaking expressed through floods, droughts, rampant epidemics, and melting glaciers. Suddenly there was a wrenching sound. Water cascaded through the top of my tent. The rainfly flap had torn loose. I cursed myself for not paying more attention to details when I set it up, then quickly gathered my belongings, flicked on my flashlight, and made a mad dash through the torrential rain into the house where our meetings were conducted. To my relief, I found a couch with a blanket and cushion, as though someone had left it there for me. I removed my sopping clothes, settled in, and fell asleep to the sound of the storm battering against the cliffs below. Chapter 56. Changing the Myth. I woke up early and peered through the window. The sun was just rising, not a cloud visible anywhere. Despite the glorious weather, I had a nagging feeling, embarrassed at the thought that the Amazon adventurer had done such a sloppy job at securing his tent. I slipped into my soggy clothes and crept out the door. The breeze cooled the air, the sole remnant of the night storm, as I picked my way back to the small field. When I got there, I froze. The tent had disappeared. I stood gawking, wondering if somehow I had taken a wrong turn. The circle of yellow grass in a storm-flattened sea of green told me otherwise. Perhaps someone had already been there and dismantled it. But who? Why? My eyes were drawn to the shoreline far below. The storm had kicked up giant waves. A couple of ambitious surfers bobbed in the breakers. Then I spotted something in the fir trees near the edge of the cliff. A globe of nylon, the color of my tent. I hurried to it. Amazingly, it was intact, on its side but still fastened to its frame. Cautiously, I hauled it out and up the slope. Other than a slightly bent aluminum rod and a lot of mud, the tent seemed none the worse for its wanderings. I went about resetting it, this time much more carefully, giving extra attention to the rainfly flap. I returned to the house and found a bucket. Grateful not to encounter other participants, I filled it with water, lugged it to my tent, and scrubbed away the mud. After finishing, I took a stroll along the clifftop path. The rain had brought out the scent of fir trees. I came to a wooden bench. The sun at my back, I sat down, faced the ocean, and thought about frailty. First my own. I had ignored a key tenet of camping. Always anticipate the worst. Expect a storm. As an EHM, I had found it equally as easy to ignore the facts behind the myth of my job. I was creating an empire, rather than making the world a saner, safer, more compassionate place, serving the corporatocracy instead of solving the problems of poverty. Then I thought about the frailty of the Mitsubishi executive. Like so many others, he had refused to expect a storm, to anticipate that raping rainforests would ultimately destroy his children's futures. I guessed that he had convinced himself that some inventive mind would discover a way to postpone the long-term suffering. Solar and wind power, hybrid autos, hydroponics farming. He, like most of us, could find excuses. Watching the waves crash against the beach in the distance below, I thought about how most of the people who attend Dream Change workshops or join our trips to the Amazon seem to take for granted that corporate executives are amoral at best and evil at worst, and that the corporations are so powerful that no one can possibly turn them around. This, too, was a distortion, a type of denial that shifted responsibility away from us, the people. If corporations are omnipotent and their leaders evil, then there is nothing the rest of us can do other than accept their advertising and convince ourselves that we need more of their products. RAN and its volunteers were changing the myth. They were telling corporate executives to use their inventive minds wisely, and at the same time demonstrating to the rest of us that those executives are neither amoral nor evil, that corporations are not omnipotent, and that we are not impotent. They were telling us, executives and everyone else, that we must accept responsibility for our lives and the world we will pass on to our progeny. When I rose from that bench, I felt inspired. The hot tub meeting had opened my eyes to new possibilities. That day and the next, I concentrated on talking with the attendees who worked for big corporations. As an EHM, I had known such people. I had been one of them, and had taught workshops for them and had mixed with them at seminars and cocktail parties. The fact that they were at this conference indicated that they were open to alternative ways of doing business, but I had an even more specific set of questions in mind. I wanted to study them in a new way, to test a hypothesis. If the hypothesis was true that most are decent people who desire to pass a better world on to their offspring and who welcome interference from organizations like RAN, then the implications were staggering. I continued to test my hypothesis. In addition to talking with corporate managers, I also read studies conducted by others. I concluded that although among executives there are pathological personalities, people who have no regard for the life and well-being of anyone other than themselves, their numbers are small, probably reflecting those in society at large. Most executives care passionately about the consequences of their actions and about the world they will leave to their children and grandchildren. While it may be part of their corporate culture to fear the Randy Hayeses of the world, deep in their hearts, they welcome them. When an organization like RAN hangs banners on their headquarters, those executives give a very quiet sigh of relief. Shortly after reaching these conclusions, I was hit with a number of personal crises, family illnesses, and my father's death. I reduced my activities to the essentials, trips to the Amazon and workshops that had been scheduled far in advance, and set all other projects aside. Then 9/11 struck. After my visit to Ground Zero, I focused on writing my book Confessions, and following its success, on speaking tours. It was not until I took that 2006 flight to RAN's fundraiser that I once again pondered the deeper implications of its campaigns against Mitsubishi and so many other bastions of the corporatocracy. I realized during that flight that if we are to change a world ruled by the corporatocracy, we must change the corporations. The more I thought about this, the more convinced I became that Randy and his staff and their volunteers had hidden something huge. Those picket lines and banners were the contemporary equivalent of the crates of tea tossed into Boston Harbor. And you had to throw the tea before you could win at Saratoga. Chapter 57. The New Capitalism. RAN does not fit the profile of the type of organization that intimidates the world's most powerful corporations. In 2006, its staff and budget were less than 40 people and $4 million, amazingly small considering the job they do. I traveled several times to San Francisco and met with many of those people after that initial speaking engagement. Susceptible to pressure, RAN's chairman of the board, Jim Gollin, responded when I asked him about the weak spot of the corporatocracy. "We see time and again that they can be persuaded to make major policy changes." Fluent in Japanese, Jim had been one of the first Westerners to work in the Tokyo headquarters of what was at the time the largest securities firm in the world, Nomura, then traveled around the globe for Morgan Stanley, and started his own investment company. He understands the corporate world. To persuade them to change, you have to be flexible, adjust to the situation. Jim described Home Depot as an example. They were the world's largest retailer of lumber and not interested in dealing with us. So we gradually turned up the heat with demonstrations at stores and shareholders' meetings. A friend on the inside leaked us the security code for the intercom system in a store, and it turned out that every store had the same code. One day, our volunteers punched in the code and announced, "Attention Home Depot shoppers! A sale on wood in aisle 10. This wood was ripped from the Amazon. There may be blood spilled on the floor. Please be careful. Cutting this wood is leading to the dislocation of indigenous communities, soil degradation, and the destruction of the earth." Once we got our student allies organized, we could hit up to 162 stores in a single day. As you can imagine, the phones rang off the hook at the Home Depot headquarters in Atlanta. Then they wanted to talk. When they agreed to stop selling old-growth timber and wood from endangered forests, the other major lumber retailers, such as Lowe's, decided to join them. "I'm a capitalist," Jim admitted. "Corporations are the most dynamic forces in the world today. They've got the power, the energy to create change. It's up to us to make it happen. I believe in activism." Fortune magazine referred to RAN as a mosquito in the tent because the organization has never allowed itself to be intimidated by the size of its targets. Among other corporations that have capitulated to RAN's demands are Kinko's, Staples, Boise Cascade, Citigroup, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, McDonald's, and Goldman Sachs. Randy Hayes turned the day-to-day management of RAN over to Mike Brune in 2003, although the founder himself continued to serve as a very active board president. The new executive director had previously been campaign director and had demonstrated his prowess at shaping strategy. He explained to me that people cannot understand how a $4 million organization is able to convince $100 billion corporations to change their policies. "We're part of a larger global justice movement," Mike said. "The nonviolent shock troops for a loosely organized network of environmental organizations, socially responsible investors, enlightened philanthropists, and sympathetic insiders. Organizations we partner with include Forest Ethics, BankTrack, World Wildlife Fund, Friends of the Earth, Amazon Watch, the Pachamama Alliance, the Ruckus Society, Greenpeace, Global Exchange, the Sierra Student Coalition, the Student Environmental Action Coalition, Rainforest Action Group, and others. We have great hope that we actually can change corporate America." He smiled. I asked him why he was so confident. "Four reasons. The first is that we have the truth on our side. Our global economy, and indeed the quality of all life, depends on a stable climate, flourishing biodiversity, clean air and water. These are all basic human rights, really. As the bumper sticker says, there are no jobs on a dead planet. Second, corporate executives and CEOs accept this as true. Many of them are beginning to realize, slowly, that they can be part of the solution, not part of the problem. Third, we see these corporations as potential allies. We work with them, identifying win-wins. We advise them on policy solutions and celebrate responsible leadership. Finally, we won't give up. The vast majority of the public supports environmental protection, and groups like RAN will hold these companies accountable. A key is understanding the mindsets of executives. Elise Hoag, director of RAN's global finance campaign, was raised by a stockbroker father. "People forget," she told me, "that corporations consist of human beings, many with children. They're very concerned about the future." RAN's approach took on a new significance with a 2006 program called Jumpstart Forward. Its goal is to change a corporation that is not generally associated with forest destruction. As campaign director Jennifer Krill points out, cars use oil. A lot of oil comes from rainforests. Besides, oil is the single biggest contributor to climate change, which impacts forests and all of us. This campaign sends a signal that RAN's goal is broader than its name suggests. Krill has no doubts about the outcome of Project Jumpstart Forward. Every RAN campaign has produced tangible results. "The question is not whether we will succeed," she says. "The question is, will we do it in time? Not if the corporatocracy gets its way." The House Ways and Means Committee subpoenaed RAN to hand over information on every protest it has conducted since 1993. In a move that typifies the cozy relationship between big business and the U.S. Congress, the investigation aims at revoking RAN's tax-exempt status. According to Mike Bruhn, his organization is complying fully. On May 31, 2005, it handed over hundreds of documents and video footage. "It's costing us time and money," Mike confirmed, shaking his head sadly. "We're determined to protect our donors from a possible witch hunt. So we removed every name and face from the material we gave them. What a job. But we want to demonstrate that we believe in the system, and we also don't intend to be bullied." I asked him how he felt about the Ways and Means Committee's action. He paused. "How do I feel? On the one hand, it pisses me off. They should be going after the companies that abuse their power, not groups like ours who are trying to protect our kids' heritage. On the other hand, I hope it will alert the American public to the power we all have, especially when we come together and organize ourselves. Congress doesn't go after a small nonprofit unless very important people feel terribly threatened." In the days and weeks following those meetings in San Francisco, I became aware that a lot of very important people are feeling threatened by many NGOs. The corporatocracy is still officially in control, but they're beginning to realize that their days are numbered.